You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 34 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. If you haven't already, you can follow us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast and swing by the Facebook page, Social Media and Politics Podcast. All right, y'all. As you may be able to hear, I am out of the studio and in the city of Tampere, Finland, and I am here for the 23rd Nordic Conference on Media and Communication Research, also known as Nord Media, and it's a conference that covers everything from journalism to politics to conflict resolution to gender and sexuality, so really a lot of stuff going on, and it's been a really nice conference, and I actually met a couple podcast listeners while I was here, so if you guys are tuning in, thank you, and you rock. And for those that I haven't met, you also rock. By the time you're listening to this episode, we should be passing the 20,000 download mark, which is pretty substantial. So thank you guys for tuning in. One of the things I wanted to do while I was here at the conference was make a podcast episode. And so I grabbed Dr. Nico Carpentier. Now that's an Americanized version of a Belgian surname. But Dr. Carpentier is a professor at the Department of Informatics and Media at Uppsala University. And for those who don't know Uppsala, it's a very famous Swedish university outside of Stockholm. And Dr. Carpentier is one of the world's leading researchers in media and participation, and he's just published a new book called The Discursive Material Knot, Cyprus and Conflict and Community Media Participation. So I didn't know much about the Cyprus conflict until I spoke with Dr. Carpentier, but on the island of Cyprus, there is actually a border separating those who identify with a Greek tradition of being a Cypriot and those who are of Turkish descent. So there is actually a militarized border, and in that buffer zone, there is a radio station that brings together people from both sides of the conflict, and it creates a very interesting space where this conflict is sort of mediated and discussed. So we're going to get into that and also talk about all things media and participation, which is Dr. Carpentier's niche. But before we get to the interview, I have two announcements regarding the show. The first is that I recently did an interview for a podcast called Podcast of the Day, and it's hosted by a guy named Grant Pollant-Mir, who works for a radio streaming app service called Anchor FM. And it's basically Grant interviewing different podcast creators, asking them about their motivations and a little bit of, you know, backstory behind the show. So I participated in that, and I'll put a link to the episode in the show notes as well as on our Facebook page. And it's a quick listen. It's about 20 minutes. If you're interested to hear more about the kind of backstory to this podcast, go ahead and check that out. Now, the second thing is I'm going to be applying for some grant money in order to kind of professionalize this podcast. There's a couple things I want to do. I alluded to it a little bit in episode 13, which is basically I want to create a sort of video YouTube programming tutorial. So kind of teaching you guys or anyone who's interested how to collect social media data, how to harvest it, and how to do some analysis on it. So I'm going to be putting in for a grant for that. Also, I want to run a couple micro-targeting campaigns, try out some of the stuff that we've been hearing about on the show. So what I'd like to ask you guys for, what will help strengthen that application, is to take a very short survey, somewhere in the range of 3 to 5 minutes, basically asking, are you male or female? Where do you live? What's your level of education? This will help me basically sell this project to the grant funders. So there's two ways to access that survey. Again, it'll take you all of 3 minutes. One way is to go directly into the show notes, the description for this show, and I'll put a link there. I'd recommend that if you're on a mobile. If you're on a computer or a laptop, check out www.socialmediaandpolitics.org. Yes, I'm working on starting a web page. I'm trying to learn WordPress. It is not very intuitive, so the website is still under construction. However, I have figured out how to have a background video that is the Game of Thrones intro, but instead of having all the cities in Westeros, you have social media companies. So Check that out. It's pretty cool. But there'll be a link for the audience survey right there on the homepage. So again, socialmediaandpolitics.org. You'll be able to access a survey from both a mobile device and a computer, but you just won't get the cool Game of Thrones video if you're on your mobile device. And that's WordPress. That's not me. I don't get it. But I would really appreciate you taking the time to fill out the survey, both because it would help strengthen this application, and I could do some live streaming and some of these programming tutorials that I've been really wanting to do for some time, and also because I'm very curious as to who's listening to the show. And other than the Twitter account, I can kind of see, you know, who's following, but I actually don't know who's listening. So I'd really be interested to see those demographics. So please take the time to do that. And without further ado, let me turn it over to Dr. Nico Carpentier, where we'll be talking about media, participation, social media, and the Cyprus conflict. And hope you enjoy the interview. My guest today is Nico Carpentier.
The French version.
Yes. My guest today is Dr. Nico Carpentier, professor at the Department of Informatics and Media at Uppsala University. His latest book is The Discourse of Material Not, Cyprus in Conflict and Community Media Participation, published by Peter Lang. Dr. Carpentier, thanks so much for taking the time out. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics podcast.
Well, my pleasure.
So recently, on episode 31 of the podcast, we spoke with Dr. Scott Wright about the potential of online spaces for deliberative democracy, which is one way of thinking about democracy. Mm-hmm. And you've been more focused in your research on the concept of participation. Can you give us your take on deliberative democracy and where participation fits into the equation?
Well, it's sort of the hell of a question to start with, because it's a pretty complicated question and unavoidably answer, because they're partially overlapping and partially different. Of course, the logics of deliberation is very much about a society of a community engaging in a dialogue, right? That's the basic idea. And out of that dialogue comes something like public opinion, however you want to formulate it, whatever kind of words, concepts you want to use. But there's something coming out of that that then, in a way, solidifies discourse. And that's one idea. But the participatory logics would then ask the question, yeah, but who decides on that? Mm-hmm. Right? What are the power dynamics in there? And that would be very much a question of how equal are these power dynamics? Because mm-hmm. you can imagine a deliberative process that may be minimalist in its participatory dimension or be very maximalist. And in that sense, it's a very different approach, but they still overlap, because deliberation is still a form of participation. Mm-hmm. But I think that the participatory approach would ask different questions. It would raise the issue like, okay, but if you look at the formation of public opinion, to use the very old formulation, if you look at that formation, well, whose voices are in there? What are the power dynamics when these issues are being created, and who's excluded, mm-hmm. who's not there? Mm-hmm. But also it then becomes a matter of asking yourself the question, yeah, but how can we decentralize power? How can we make sure that it becomes more equalized as a process and not necessarily as a given, mm-hmm. Not something that is fixed, but something that is created and improved? And in that sense, there is a huge similarity in both the deliberative and the participatory approaches, because I think that what drives them is also this idea, well, democracy is not fixed. Democracy is a process. It's something that is created
right.
through the actual performance of democracy itself. Mm-hmm. And deliberation or participation are practices that generate democracy. Its opposite. The absence of these practices destroys it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's definitely a lot to chew on there. And I want to ask you a little bit about the kind of concept of participation. So you mentioned in your presentation there's a difference between the sociological and the political yeah. approach. Yeah. Can you break that down for us?
Well, one of the things I've been doing is that I've been looking at a wide variety of academic fields that deal with participation. And it's fascinating, and it surprised me. Like, it's like you go to the seaside and you sort of turn around the stone and you look underneath and then you see, oh yeah, there's participation there. Mm-hmm. That group, that community actually thinks about participation in this way. I got interested in health practices. Right? So the relationship between doctors and patients. Mm. There's actually work on the participatory dimensions of that relationship.
So in terms of maybe signing up for a trial?
Who decides, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, who decides on a therapy? If a doctor tells you, hey guys, sorry, but you're going to die, you want to sort of respond to that. Mm-hmm. And in being a Belgian, of course, knowing the euthanasia laws quite well, I've actually worked with people doing research in that area, that raises issues on agency, right? Who gets to decide on, for instance, if you're granted euthanasia or not? But if you, if a doctor tells you, well, I'm sorry, but you're ill and we need to have this therapy, in some cases, there are mechanics that allow people to say, no, I don't want that therapy. And in sort of sociology of health, there are a number of people that actually study that power balance from a participatory perspective. But if you look at the arts, you'll find the community arts movement that's been talking about participation and thinking through the relationship of the artist with visitors that are allowed to become incorporated in the creation of the artwork itself. So wherever you start looking, you'll find discussions about participation. One of the most interesting things is that they're often quite different. And what I've been trying to do is to sort of figure out a way of dealing with that complexity. And the answer I came up with, which is based on sort of this digging into all these different fields, is of course too simple. But nevertheless, it works, I think, in understanding this complexity. Because on the one hand, you have a series of communities and a series of ways of thinking about participation, which I've grouped under this label of a sociological approach. Mm-hmm. And that's approaching participation from a very simple and basic idea. Participation is taking part. That's one big family. And you'll find that in different approaches. I've labeled it the sociological approach because it does have a prominence in sociology. Mm-hmm. But then there's another family, another approach. And these are the academics and the traditions that say, well, no, it's not just about taking part. It's about co-deciding. It's about who is empowered to take decisions in particular cases. And this comes out of a subset of political studies, actually a subset of political theory, namely democratic theory. And the work of Carol Pateman is one classic example. Where she's very interested in decision-making and in the dynamics of power. And of course, these are just two very sort of obvious and very simple categories. But if you then start looking through the lens of these two approaches, if you then start looking at how are people working with participation, it makes a lot of sense because you then see differences. Mm-hmm. And then you can at least get some sort of a map and understand how particular academics, particular texts are dealing with participation. Mm-hmm. And for me, that difference is quite crucial because in one case, in the sociological approach, interaction, access, participation, they're basically the same thing. Right? If you go to a museum and you are exposed to a piece of art, you're participating in the meanings that are generated. You're participating in culture, as they would say. If you take the more political approach and you're standing there as well in front of this piece of art and somebody asks you the question, who decides on this? Who decides on hanging that painting there? Who decides on painting it? Mm-hmm. You as a visitor did it, but you are interacting with it. You're absorbing its meanings. You're trying to interpret it. In some cases, you can even move it if you want to and if they let you. But that's what I would call interaction. So in the political studies approach, you can distinguish between participation, as in co-deciding, and interacting with it. And that becomes a different thing. While in the sociological approach, it's all part of the same. If you go and shop, then you're participating in consumption culture, I usually joke. But that's one way of understanding the sociological approach.
Right. It's definitely something that, you know, I'm coming from political science where participation has a very narrow definition for some, but people are trying to broaden it up, and especially in terms of social media. But I want to ask you, you've done a lot of work on a concept you've discussed as participatory media. So yep. Looking at participation through the media. What is participatory media?
Well, the discussions that we sort of were having were very general because you could take this notion of participation and then connect it to any kind of setting, to any kind of organizational structure. We were talking about hospitals. Sure, you can talk about the relationship between a doctor and a patient as a participatory or non-participatory relationship, depending on what's happening there. But of course, you can take that same discussion and you take that to the media sphere. And then you can start asking yourself the question, if we look at a particular setting where meaning is organized and the creation of meaning is organized, which could be a definition of media, if you look at that setting, is that a participatory setting or not? And a lot of the research I did in the 90s and early 2000s was also looking at mainstream media and their projects, their attempts to create participation in particular programs, talk shows, discussion programs, documentary formats, in some cases film. And I was interested in a very simple question. Can mainstream media actually organize these participatory processes? The answer was pretty negative. Well, if you want to be a bit of an optimist, you could say, well, they're minimalist participatory, yes, but they're very minimalist.
And is that the example that immediately comes to mind for me would be something like whether it's a reality show where people actually make the program themselves, or perhaps, you know, more today where mainstream news organizations will show tweets, for example. Is that what you mean by minimalist?
Exactly. That these are sort of a variation of fields in mainstream media where you can do this kind of participatory research. If you look at reality television, the answer is even worse. I've been analyzing Temptation Island, a wonderful program, lots of fun. It's the most anti-empathic program ever.
And I vaguely recall it.
It's the idea of let's have couples, let's select four couples, let's split them up, and let's put the male partners on an island with nothing but female bachelors, and put the female partners on an island with nothing but male bachelors, and the assignment that the bachelors get is to destroy the relationship. Mm-hmm. It is a very antisocial program. It's mm-hmm. deeply problematic if you look at it. But from a participatory perspective, some have argued, well, this is a form of participation. I would say, well, no, because they hardly have any choices on these islands. And the entire format, the way that the production team functions, is geared against any kind of participation. There is interaction, of course. You mm-hmm. interact in ways that you probably don't always want to see. But that is not a participatory process, at least not in this political definition. Mm-hmm. In talk shows, in different kinds of journalism, the use of tweets, they're minimalist participatory practices. The use of comments, when it actually goes into the online versions of newspapers, these are minimalist participatory practices. But the question is simple, right? If you have a piece of online journalism and you're allowed to comment, and the question is, well, who decides on the piece of journalism itself? Mm-hmm. Obviously not the people that comment.
So what would be an example then of a maximalist participation?
So then you go into the other side, because one of the kind of research projects, series of research projects I was interested in was this mainstream media with its very weak forms of participation. But then of course the question is, yeah, but is there something else? Are there maximalist versions? And there you often go to civil society media, to community media, to alternative media, to environments where small-scale groups and small-scale organizations can actually control together in a very democratic, participatory democratic way, control the media organization itself and control the content. And that there's a very long history of organizing these maximalist processes, but it's a very... especially, with the exception of specialists, of course, but people that are not familiar with community media wouldn't know these examples. They're quite often underground examples. Mm-hmm. They're hidden. You have to look for them to find them.
Right. We had one of the previous episodes, we interviewed a representative from a social network called Gab, which is a freedom of speech, no censorship type of thing. And they're almost entirely funded by donations from, you know, they have target goals every week. Would that be an example of maximalist participation, where the users actually fund the operations?
I think funding is one of the key questions, but not the only question. So again, you go into the analysis, then you start asking yourself the question, yeah, but who decides on this? But that's not one question, right? It's a question on, well, but who decides on the broadcasts? If it's a radio station, now using that as an example, or who decides on what's being published online? But also who decides on the interface? Who decides on the financial structure that is behind that? Who decides on the decision-making to make decision?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's a whole range of questions that you then need to ask before you can say, hey, this is a maximalist participatory organization. At the same time, we should keep in mind that this ultimate, total, fully maximalist organization probably doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a number of people, including myself, have argued that's a utopian model. But what you can do is push it closer to that maximalist version, and a number of groups have done that.
What about, I'm thinking about social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, which really don't produce content themselves, but are almost driven entirely by the content that we as users produce. So what does social media bring to the table in terms of participation? Where would you consider that a minimalist participation act, where the entire communication and information flows that are going on across these platforms is driven by users who participate?
It is, of course, one of the questions that people that are dealing with participatory theory are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and obviously, there's no easy answer. They're participatory hybrids. And again, you need to ask these same questions. I think Stuart Hall once used the notion of the interrogation, right, as an analytical method. You need to interrogate particular practices, particular organizations, ask them the hard questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you do participatory research, you ask these kind of environments the hard questions. Who decides? Who decides on the interface? Obviously not the users.
Right.
Who decides on content? In many cases, of course, the postings are made, but still in cases that organizations like Facebook decide that this is a violation of their codes of conduct, they will remove. And it's not something that is without contestation, obviously, but there is a very strong power position that the company, by the way, it's a company that the company has. And we should not forget that. But still, people are using this platform to express themselves. So there is a level of participation at the level of content creation, no discussion about that, but structurally, they're big issues.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a distinction between structural participation and content related participation. And I think that if we look at Facebook, to use that one as an example, yes, there is content related participation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's structured, even the content itself, it's structured in very particular ways. Even the ways that material is actually, we can say it's being broadcast. Well, actually not really, because the algorithm decides on what is shown to who, what way, in what order. So there's not that much control that you have. I mean, as users of, for instance, Facebook, we type in things, we actually post it, and then we assume that it's published. But it's not that straightforward, because the algorithm does have an impact on actual distribution.
Right.
So again, these are the hard questions that you need to ask.
It gets very difficult because, you know, users can tag others in a post that would help direct.
Yeah.
But that feature itself is embedded in the digital architecture of that platform. So it starts to get very, very sticky very quick. And this is kind of a very normative question, but do you think that these types of social media have an empowering role for people, in particular in terms of politics and political processes?
One of the other distinctions I've been working with is it's a very simple wordplay. It's the distinction between participation in and participation through, right? Because you can participate in a particular media organization. And then you ask a particular set of hard questions about the power dynamics within that environment. And that's what we've been doing so far. I mean, if you're talking about community media, and the question is, well, who decides about the broadcast? If you talk about Facebook, who decides about the posting? Who decides about the infrastructure within the organization? And that's one big set of questions. But there is also another set of questions. And that's related to participation through, for instance, a particular media organization. Because through different kinds of social media, but also other kinds of more alternative media, if you want to go to the zines, if you want to go to online community radio, right? through these media organizations, you can express yourself. You can have your voice heard. Mm-hmm. And that's a different dynamics. They're not necessarily connected. In some cases, they are. But for instance, in a lot of social media, they're not, because your participation in that media environment is fairly limited, if even the word participation is appropriate there. But the participation through these media is vital from a democratic perspective, from a participatory perspective. But then you don't participate in the organization. You actually use that organization to have your voice heard. But then you go into different dynamics and different hard questions and different obstacles. Because, yes, you can have a wonderful, and there we go back to deliberative democracy. Yes, you can have a wonderful chat with all these voices, but then you go into the question, yeah, but so what? Mm-hmm. What happens with these voices? And that's also a question you can frame as who decides. Because opinion formation is, of course, also a process that is linked to a whole range of decisions. Can you, as an individual, actually weigh on that debate? Can you actually impact on it? Do you have a say? And then we go back to political theory and all the discussions about voting. Right? What is the chance that one individual can actually, with his or her vote, can change the outcome of the elections? Mm-hmm. Minimal.
Yeah.
But in some cases, and there have been also in analysis of voting, very well documented cases where a few people really have that power. Mm-hmm. And in different kinds of decisions, whether it's online, whether it's offline, whether it's in a town hall meeting, in these particular cases, people can have an impact as an individual or as a group of people. So then you need to look at what's actually going on in particular cases. And that's the bigger point I do want to make. Because a lot of the theories about participation, in particular participation in combination with politics, they are very generalizing. They make statements about, not just about one platform, they make statements about the social media and the democracy and the political realm. That's not how it works, and that's not what you can analyze. What we need much more is to look at the nitty-gritty mechanics of particular environments, on particular themes, in particular moments, and see what happens there. Because a lot of these discussions and a lot of these political moments of decision-making are hyper-contextualized. And you can only understand the participatory dynamics if you take that context into consideration. And then just making very general statement saying we're living in a participatory culture, that might be a bit difficult to substantiate with actual research, because if you start looking at the different cases, you'll see cases where you can find actual examples of high levels of participation by a number of very empowered citizens. But you can also find cases where everybody is basically blabbering and nothing happens. And then you need to look at the dynamics in these particular cases, but then to make general statements about the democratic nature of, for instance, social media is utterly methodologically, analytically, and theoretically problematic.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's put that theory into practice a little bit and talk about a concrete case, which is your most recent book, which again is called The Discursive Material Knot, Cyprus and Conflict and Community Media Participation. Let's foreground a little bit about Cyprus and I know you could probably go into it for.
About to ask, like, how much time do I got?
Just in the sense of, I was reading a little bit about the conflict that obviously has a huge history, but it's something that I think, you know, a lot of people know Cyprus as a vacation destination, but there is a very controversial issue going on there, right?
It is a very complicated history, and it's extremely difficult to sort of give the very short version. I usually joke and say, like, yeah, maybe we should start in 1571, which is not very helpful. It's actually the moment where the island became part of the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. But there are many parts of this history. What we now have at this moment still is a divided island. And there is a buffer zone, which is a militarized part of the island going straight through the island, separating the island into two parts.
And is that a material border?
That is a very material border. Mm-hmm. The minefields have been cleared, okay. mostly. There are a couple of places where you probably shouldn't go. But it's like a wall. I mean, imagine the Berlin Wall. That's the kind of image that we all know. Well, this is not that different. So if you go into the buffer zone, then you go into an area which is potentially still lethal.
Mm-hmm. And it separates between Greeks and Turks, right?
Well, I would say Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots.
Okay,
but that's a little because that's a sensitive issue.
Mm-hmm.
But originally, the island was very mixed. People were living in the same city, so Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots, actually before they were called Orthodox Cypriots and Muslim Cypriots, but labels were changed out of nationalist logics. People were living together, not always sort of merging into one population, but they were actually cohabitating the island. And in the 50s, 1950s, the 1960s, 1970s, we saw a whole range of military conflicts, extremely bloody and extremely traumatizing, ripped the island apart, resulting in a situation now where the Turkish Cypriots are living in the north and the Greek Cypriots are living in the south, where the north is controlled by a republic which is not internationally recognized. That's the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. It's only recognized by Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
There are about 30 to 40,000 Turkish soldiers in that part of the island, so it's highly militarized there. In the south, you'll find Greek Cypriots living there. The Republic of Cyprus controls that part of the island. So what we find in practice are two states. One, the Republic of Cyprus, Greek Cypriot, recognized by the international community. And in the north, Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, Turkish Cypriots living there, combined with Turks that migrated from mainland Turkey, but in a republic that's not recognized. And what's keeping them apart is, at this moment, the buffer zone, which is controlled by the United Nations as a peacekeeping operation.
And is it that the Turkish Cypriots want to take over the entire island? Is it about the island as a whole, or is it just a kind of agree to disagree?
Well, that is a very difficult question because it really depends on who you ask the question. The answer will be structurally different. If you would ask me, once you engage in conflict for decades, there is no winner, no loser. There's even right and wrong stops sort of existing. What we saw in about 30 years was a very bloody conflict inspired by two nationalisms.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, I think what we saw in the 1960s was part of the Greek Cypriot community that wanted to enforce an ethnic cleansing of the island, get rid of the Turkish Cypriots. Unfortunately for that nationalist fantasy, that didn't work. Obviously, it doesn't work. You can't just deport something like 150,000 people. That's a stupid fantasy. And what basically happened was that Turkey intervened to protect that minority.
Mm-hmm.
That intervention was a military intervention. It was an invasion of the island. In Turkey would call it a peace operation.
Mm-hmm.
It was a military invasion. The island got separated because of that military invasion. A lot of Greek Cypriots died in the fighting. And actually, a considerable number of Turkish Cypriots actually also died in the fighting. There were massacres on both sides during that part. But what happened was that Turkey, as a military force, simply occupied about a bit more than one third of the island. And that was condemned by the international community as an act of aggression. So what we have now is a situation where, especially after Cyprus joined the European Union, we actually have part of the European Union that is occupied by Turkey. That's the situation as we have it now.
So it's a very interesting conflict. For me, it draws parallels to the Israel-Palestine and sort of contesting of national sovereignty. What were you looking to do in the book in terms of this conflict?
Well, one of the things that interests me is to look how participatory media, so a maximalist participatory media organization, at the same time became a peace builder.
Mm.
That was the big issue for me. And of course, I've studied participatory media for a long time, and I've been interested and I've been doing conflict studies in parallel. But in this particular case, I was interested to see how these two logics participation on the one hand and conflict transformation, peace building on the other, how they came together in one organization. Mm-hmm. And one of my big arguments was that that organization, so the CCMC, the community, the Cyprus Community Media Center, how they were at the same time contributing to the democratization of the media on Cyprus, and at the same time were actually a key component in bringing these communities together, in creating a more peaceful set of interactions between Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots, but also including some of the other communities on the island, because these are the two main communities and they're part of the conflict. But there are also Russians, Brits living on the island. There's a large Filipino community on the island. And there are many other communities on the island. And what that broadcaster was doing is actually moving away from this dichotomy, Turkish Cypriots versus Greek Cypriots, and including different groups and different communities mm-hmm. That are part of the culture of the island into their little studio in the buffer zone in Nicosia,
right,
the capital of Cyprus.
That's what I wanted to say. I thought it was really interesting in your presentation. You have, this media organization is right in the buffer zone. I mean, they are at the wall, so to say.
And it's a very, very strange place, because if you enter, you, of course, go into this militarized area. But there are two checkpoints, right, on each side. So there's a Greek Cypriot checkpoint, and on the other side is a Turkish Cypriot checkpoint. There are passport controls. Of course, some, for good legal reasons, some would argue that the Turkish Cypriot passport control is actually illegal because it's a non-recognized state. Mm-hmm. But of course, they do. I mean, they are de facto exist. But what you also see is a lot of references to the nationalist project. So it's all surrounded with flags. If you enter through the southern side into that crossing where the radio station is, the first thing you see is two gigantic concrete slabs that are there for military purposes to avoid people just going straight through. You have to zigzag through this entry point, which slows you down. Well, for military reasons, that's important. But they're colored in the colors of the Greek flag. The Greek Cypriot nationalism was actually a Greek nationalism. It was about joining Greece. Mm-hmm. So it's not a coincidence that the Greek colors are there. And on the other side of that entry point, you see two martyrs, two people that were killed in 1996, Greek Cypriots that were killed by the Turkish Cypriots. So you get all these symbols if you enter that place. If you go back like 20 meters, you'll find a little bunker there, one of the leftovers of the fighting. If you look at Ledra Palace, which is the big hotel in the middle of the buffer zone, you can still see the bullet holes. So you enter into this hyper militarized zone that used to be a battlefield, and that is still very much an object of surveillance and control by these two statist actors. And then you enter into a totally different kind of space, because in the middle, the UN has been protecting that area quite well. You'll find a radio station that is all about democracy. You find the Home for Cooperation, which is a center for these kinds of bi-community activities. It has a wonderful bar, there's a lovely terrace out there, so you enter into this area and you can have a wonderful, well, you can call it a Cypriot coffee.
And stay at the hotel next door.
Well, the hotel is taken by the British soldiers, so you can't get in and surf for that.
So this CCMC, yeah. This radio station, what do they do? What is their mission?
Well, they do... The obvious thing that anybody would answer is, well, they're a community radio station, so they broadcast, and they're webcasting. So people from the two sides, depending where you enter, right, they go there and they produce radio content. They work together, so you'll find Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots, but also all these other communities, literally working together producing stuff. So it's very much about what they're broadcasting, and that will be the obvious first answer. Mm-hmm. If you start analyzing the broadcasts, and I've been doing that, if you analyze these programs, these different episodes, you'll find all sorts of mechanics that contribute to building peace. And I mean, you could talk about that forever. But the point I want to make is that it's not just about these broadcasts. I would argue that there's also a very material side to what they're doing, they're creating a space in this buffer zone, which is this weird hybrid liminal space. They're creating a space of togetherness. And it's conflictuous togetherness. It's not that it's love, peace, and harmony. I mean, they're human beings. They're very diverse. So you have conflicts there. But they manage to overcome, resolve these little conflicts in the radio station to work together, to show that together, as Turkish Cypriots, Greek Cypriots, and many other communities, they can actually keep that organization alive. They can organize themselves in more participatory, grassroots ways. It's very much about that studio. It's the materiality of that studio where people go, work together, be together, decide together, produce together, co-create together. And that, it's not just about the broadcasts, I would argue. It's very much about the materiality of that space where representatives, between citation marks, of these different communities are actually working together.
Mm-hmm.
And in a context where people have been killing each other, that's a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
That really matters. And it gets absurd, right? If you take like 20 steps out of the studio, you're in the main street, that's the crossing. If you take another 20 steps, then you're talking to a police officer that is guarding the place, and you see all these very fancy Greek flags on one side or Turkish flags on the other side that really bring you back to this nationalist project.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very contradictory. But in that little safe haven, you'll find discursive and material peace building agonistic logics.
And is it a station or a media that gets a lot of attention because of that? I mean, if the materiality of the space is where things are happening, so to say, then is it only constrained to those people who are working there, or is it setting an example for a broader community?
That brings us to a lot of the limits that they're dealing with and a lot of opportunities that they have, because they reach out to what is called the bi-community movement. So the political movement that wants to unite the island, that actually wants to what they would call solve the Cyprus problem. So it's not the radio station on its own. It's part of a network of civil society organizations that actually are very much represented in the decision-making structures of the radio station, for one, but that are also very present. And so what you actually find is what I would call a nodal point. And the radio station connects all these different initiatives because they meet there. They go and produce or be interviewed or talk or perform there in that little studio, which actually gets very hot in summer, by the way.
Because
it really gets hot there. And the air conditioning is not perfect. But so it's very much about connecting these different social struggles on the island. And that really matters. But one of the problems that they're facing is the problems related to that bi-community movement, because the bi-community movement is one political movement on the island. It's not the entire island. And there are quite a number of elites, but also a lot of political parties and a lot of other movements that don't necessarily share the perspectives of that bi-community movement. And there are many people that basically don't care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the survey studies that have been done on Cyprus are raising quite alarming messages about the younger generations not being interested in reunifying the island.
They just go about their lives.
Of course. And if you're sitting at the seaside, which is in most cases far away from this buffer zone, then you're sitting at the seaside and you're enjoying life. I mean, they've had a terrible economic crisis. It's not that youth employment is still fairly high. It's not like the total heaven on earth. But they're very far removed from the political issues related to the Cyprus problem.
Mm. One of the things I think about in terms of walls or even borders, national borders, is that social media is something that is not limited by geographical space. So are there any social media initiatives or these NGOs using social media as a way to go across that wall, so to say?
More and more. There's a long history of activism in trying to reconnect the island. The crossings where you could actually go through the buffer zone only opened in 2003. Right? And the Turkish invasion was 1974. So 1974 to 2003, there were no connections. There were no phone lines. if you wanted to call the other side of the island, if you managed to do that, you had to go through an operator. Mm. So it was extremely difficult to communicate. It was extremely difficult to meet because a lot of the activists that managed to meet, they didn't meet in Cyprus. They went abroad to meet in other countries. So that was the configuration from 74 to 2003. In the 1990s, you saw the first initiatives where the internet, the activists that knew how to use the internet, it's maybe more accurate, was also used to create these communicative environments. And these first steps were being put in the 1990s, late 1990s. And you see that that has only been increasing. But there are a couple of things. First of all, language is a huge issue. Mm. Originally, there was a lot of knowledge about the other language. So Greek Cypriots would understand Turkish or the Turkish Cypriot variation of Turkish and the other way around. The newer generations don't speak the other language anymore. English is used because it's a formerly English colony and the language knowledge of the English language is quite high, but it's not their native language. So communication is not necessarily impeded by the technology, but actually impeded by the knowledge of each other's language. And that's one of the key problems that they're facing. Secondly, if you look online, and I've been doing some research on the online discussions between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots, there's a very strong presence of nationalists. Mm. And they patrol these online environments. And if you start, I mean, for whoever is interested in this problem, if you just go to a discussion on either one of the newspapers, the online newspapers, or if you go in and look on YouTube and look at comments, you'll find flaming wars everywhere. And they're fascinating. Actually, one of the articles I wrote, the title of the article, referred to one of these confrontations where one of the participants, shall I call it participants, flamers, was sort of referring to, quote, fuck these idiots from Greece, referring to Greek Cypriots. But he misspelled Greece because his English wasn't perfect. Mm-hmm. And then the next comment came, Greece is a film with John Travolta. And I actually used the fuck the idiots from Greece as a title for an article because it was so telling. Mm-hmm. Both of the linguistic issues that are still very much making the conversation very difficult, but also the type of language and the very aggressive language that is used by a small group of people, but they managed to dominate a lot of the on the online exchanges. Mm. And I think that is one of the most frustrating parts of the work that I've been doing in the online areas of these conversations, because it's spectacular to see how the nationalist voices still manage to dominate these environments.
It's interesting. It's something that I've also found in the case of British elections and Brexit and the U.S. It's really that there is a small group with a very, very loud voice that's usually not the most deliberative to bring things all around full circle. But I'd love to keep going into this. We have a reception to catch, though, at some point.
And so, they'll lock us out at some point.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Well, Dr. Carpentier, thanks so much for taking the time out.
Yeah, thank you.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Nico Carpentier, professor of the Department of Informatics and Media at Uppsala University. His latest book is The Discursive Material Knot, Cyprus in Conflict and Community Media Participation. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Please take a moment and fill out the audience survey that you can find either in the show notes or at socialmediaandpolitics.org. Connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast. Swing by the Facebook page, Social Media and Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Tampere, Finland. See you next time.